Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. When the Soviet Union fell apart back in 1991, a lot of people felt that at that point everything would change, that Russia would embrace Western-style democracy and also Western-style capitalism. And there are a lot of people who felt that an economic boom in Russia was just around the corner. To date, however, things haven't quite worked out that way. In fact, many people would say that the Russian economy has been a great disappointment, that it's something of a basket case. And in fact, many people wonder if the boom, that expected boom, will ever come. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Russia. I'm sure we'll talk about relations between Russia and the United States. And one major focus of our conversation here will be the business climate, the business environment of Russia. And our guest for the show is James Collins, someone who is regarded to be one of the country's leading authorities on Russia and Eurasia, and also on U.S. relations with Russia and with that region. He has had a long career in the Foreign Service. He served from 1997 until 2001 as the U.S. Ambassador to the Russian Federation. Before becoming ambassador to Russia, he held a number of other posts. He was ambassador at large and special advisor to the Secretary of State for the new independent states, and also served as deputy chief of mission and chargé d'affaires with Ambassador Robert Strauss at the American Embassy in Moscow during all of those events surrounding the collapse of the Soviet Union. In addition to his diplomatic postings in Moscow, he also held management positions at the Department of State and the White House in Washington, focusing on Russian, Soviet, and Middle East affairs. He, in addition to his three postings in Moscow, had positions at the American Embassy in Amman, Jordan, and in the American Consulate General in Izmir, Turkey. He will be one of the participants of a conference that will be taking place October 12th and 13th. This is being sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center at the U of I and will be taking place in Chicago at the Palmer House Hilton. And for more information on that, I'm sure if you go to the U of I website and go to the website of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, you can find out more about that. He's been good enough to give us some of his time this morning. We're talking with him by telephone, and as we do, of course, as always, questions are welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we happen to be, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. Please, though, we ask people to be brief and help us get in as many people as possible. Well, Ambassador Collins, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
I thought I'd begin with a rather general question that's not specific to business in Russia, but because you have had quite a bit of experience in Russia, I thought you might have some interesting things to say. And that is going back to what happened there in the late 80s and the period where the Soviet Union came apart in 91 and 89. Why is it, do you think, that for so many people who had spent time studying Russia and the Soviet Union and who should have been fairly well informed about what was going on, why was it that for so many people the collapse of the Soviet Union was a surprise?
Well, I think it really boils down to the fact that something as central to Americans' thinking for a whole almost half, three-quarters of a century and that had really defined almost the entire international structure as Americans saw it for the post-World War II world, would simply evaporate in a matter of months, was sort of inconceivable to everybody. Now, people knew that there were problems and that Russia and the then Soviet Union had significant economic, political, and other problems. They were already pulling back from their post-World War II position in Eastern Europe with the Warsaw Pact dissolving and so forth. And you'd had the collapse of the Berlin Wall and all of these things. You'd also had a whole 5-6 years of reform movements that had changed some very basic things in the Soviet system. You know, openness of the press, the beginning of an electoral process that was contested and so forth. But frankly, nobody really thought that when the events in August, which really triggered the ultimate collapse in August of 1991, where the conservative forces of the Communist Party tried to sort of roll back the clock some and halt the changes that were clearly beginning to move into serious socioeconomic change, were threatening real existing interests. And they tried to oust President Gorbachev and failed. It showed the real vulnerabilities of the system. And I frankly, in those particular months, after that event, was not overly shocked that people didn't rise to the defense of the old system when it was coming apart. What the events of August 91 did, though, was really to show how fragile the system was, and it showed fissures in one or two particular ways. The first was that the republics of the then Soviet Union, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Armenia, and so forth, began to say, well, we're not going to accept these folks in Moscow telling us that we're going to turn the clock back. And they essentially moved quite forcefully to avoid being re-centralized and brought under the party's control. And that sort of unleashed the nationalist movements in each of these places and put great pressure on the Soviet system. Hmm. And then when the Russian political system itself, that is what was the Russian Federation under Boris Yeltsin at that time, which was a part of the Soviet Union, ultimately began to move in its own direction and would not necessarily support the way that Gorbachev was trying to preserve the Soviet system. That really was the handwriting on the wall. So, I mean, I think I used to jokingly say that the Soviet Union was canceled for lack of interest, but in many ways, that's exactly what happened. And there was just no one there to defend it by the end of 1991, and President Gorbachev signed a paper and hauled down the flag, and that was the end of it. And it, what was remarkable in the end is that it was completely, almost completely a bloodless change.
I'm sure that there are people who, depending upon how you feel about that, would either praise Mr. Gorbachev or blame him. And having said that, though, I'm sure that the things that happened were much more than anything that he might have done or not done. It reminds me of going back many years back to the time when the Soviet Union still existed, talking to people about Russia who said that we needed to be careful about spending too much time thinking about individual persons and personalities in trying to understand what was going on in Russia, and get a better understanding of more broad kind of, you know, social, political, economic currents that were somehow more than just individual actors. And it seems that in this case, you know, we may still be doing that in the sense that we talk about the significance of individual leaders, Yeltsin, Gorbachev, Putin maybe now. And so that just gets me thinking about were there indeed currents, you know, as I said, economic, political, social currents that were really more than any individual really could direct or certainly could prevent.
Well, of course, I think there were, I think they were probably much less well understood than they should have been by almost everybody who followed that country. And I mean, for instance, when I went out to Moscow in the fall of 1990, there was really no one in the U.S. government telling me that a sort of a crisis of the whole system was imminent. There were plenty of people who understood that, for instance, certain currents were there that were challenging the Soviet system to change and to modernize, but few thought that they were incapable of meeting the challenge. So what was identified then was one that I mentioned, that the national minorities in the Soviet system, the Baltic peoples, the Ukrainians, the Georgians, and the Turkic peoples of Central Asia, all were putting demands on the system for greater autonomy or a sense that they were being shortchanged by the system. And they were demanding more autonomy. Now, that came out and became a real movement for serious freedom from the centralized control of the Communist Party in Moscow, as the August 91 movement looked like it was going to reverse a trend toward giving them greater liberal autonomy. The second fact that was just there is that the system was under great economic strain. By the time you had got into the latter half of the 80s, the defense spending that had been going on had been eating up so much of the gross national product that there was not very much investment in other areas. The distortions and mismanagement of the economic system were not delivering what the population basically demanded of the system, which was a better standard of living and improved health, welfare, protections, education, and so forth. I mean, you know, for 10, 15 years, it was pretty hard to see a lot of improvement in people's living standards. And finally, I think there was, of course, great strain put on the system when you opened it up in certain ways, as President Gorbachev did. And I think there were two or three areas where this was particularly important. First of all, in essence, what the Communist Party under Mr. Gorbachev said was that they were not going to use massive force to keep the system alive. And what that did really was to undercut the ability in Eastern Europe, first of all, I think, of those regimes in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and so forth, to keep the system going. You know, the simple reality was that if people were not sufficiently afraid, they didn't have to give their support. And then the Soviet Union began to agree that it would pull back from Eastern Europe. The second big change was that the Communist Party began to relinquish its demand to have total control over all information. You had the glasnost movement of Gorbachev, which opened up people's eyes to a lot of the realities of their country in ways that they had never been allowed to read before or to hear before from authoritative people. And then you had what I've always thought of as the competency problem. Remember, this is the period in which you had Chernobyl, the terrible Chernobyl disaster. You also had the terrible earthquake in Armenia, which killed lots and lots of people. And it simply was a credibility problem for a lot of the elite, which claimed the right to rule the country because they knew how to do it better. And, you know, both Chernobyl and that earthquake demonstrated that they really weren't up to the job. And I think all of that undermined support for the, you know, the political leadership and the system to the point where, when really challenged, people simply were not willing to take it on. And finally, I think, you know, in the events of August 1991 and so forth surrounding that, I remember very well being there that when the army and military were brought out to try to defend the movement against the president, against Gorbachev, the population simply rose up and said to their children, you know, we don't want you to do this. And in the end, that army wasn't prepared to shoot its own citizens, and the soldiers weren't prepared to kill their mothers. And that basically removed, in some ways, the ultimate threat of force from the hands of the people trying to set the clock back. And the whole affair collapsed. At that point, it was very hard for President Gorbachev to put the credibility in the system back together again, and he never did succeed.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is James Collins. He's had a long career in the State Department. He served from 97 until 2001 as the U.S. Ambassador to the Russian Federation, had other posts there in Russia and other places around the world as well. And we're talking about Russia, and we'll be spending some of our time at least talking about economics in Russia and the business climate in Russia. The number for people who have questions, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you to talk a little bit about Russia today and about President Putin. And I think that, you know, a lot of criticism, he's received a lot of criticism for consolidating control, moving to pull control back into the hands of the central government there in Moscow, taking back control over important natural resources like oil and gas, taking over the media, trying to undercut the power of the Russian, the Duma, the parliament, undercutting the power of regional governors, trying to, as much as possible, to reconsolidate control there in Moscow, in the Kremlin. Perhaps you can just talk a little bit about that. I suppose the sort of the overall question is, yes, indeed, a lot of things have changed, but it seems that in there are some respects in which, in fact, little has changed.
Well, I'm not sure I'd accept the latter observation. I mean, I believe, frankly, that Russia today is a different country from the one that I've first went to in, you know, 1965 or when I was there in the 70s, or for that matter, when I went back in the 1990. I mean, it really is a different place, and it's a different place in at least two or three major respects. I mean, the communist system is gone, and it's not coming back. This is not a state based on communist ideology or anything like it. It is not a command economy as the Soviet system used and as the whole system was predicated upon. I mean, the reality is that Russia today is accepted, I think, by pretty much everybody as an emerging market in the financial investor terminology. And it is a market. It may be an imperfect one and may have some peculiarities, as do all of these emerging markets, but it is seen as a market economy, and it and frankly, it has most of the attributes. It is a market, certainly a market economy or an emerging market that has a heavier than or a role for the state and you know, its instruments in economic activity and in the ownership of resources that is significant. But and perhaps much more significant than, say, Americans are used to, or than some others are used to. But it is not a state-owned system as it was under the communists. So I think we make a big mistake if we think it's sort of the same as it was, or it's even going back in that direction. Now, that said, I wouldn't at all contest that, you know, the role of the government in the economy has become not necessarily greater since 1991, but it has become greater in terms of exercising its authorities over the things it owns. There was a lot of mythology about how far really the assets in Russia were privatized in the 1990s, and in fact, the government always held in many of the major areas substantial control over things that were called, say, like the transport infrastructure of the railway system, the electricity structure, the natural gas system. These were never privatized, and so there's been no going back. In fact, if anything, there has been some movement to try to move them toward more of a market. So this is simply to say that I think we make a mistake if we think this has all gone back to where it was. It really hasn't, and I think that's a mistake. Now, that said, I think it's also fair to say that Mr. Putin's period since 2000 is different from Mr. Yeltsin's period from 91 to 2000. I've always believed that the best way to look at the 1990s was the period of tearing up and tearing down the Soviet system, getting rid of the command economy, trying to put in place the basics of a market system, trying to put in base an alternative to the old one-party ideology-based political system, and to create one where the only legitimacy for power was to be selected through an electoral process of some kind, etc. And I think, you know, there was no question that Yeltsin in the 90s got rid of the communist system. He did it effectively. He was less effective in laying all the basics for what we would, I think, say was a well-functioning and disciplined democratic system. Putin came in, and he was very clear. He had three objectives. One was to restore the authority of the state. Second was to modernize the economy and get it growing. And third was to restore Russia to its international standing, which had deteriorated greatly in the time of economic collapse. And if you look at his record, I mean, he's not done too badly in two of the three. I think, you know, it's a fairly impressive record of economic change and growth and movement, even though it's less than many would have hoped. But, you know, he's working on the eighth year of sustained economic growth at rates between sort of averaging 6 to 7% a year, which is pretty good. And the macroeconomic figures, that is things like reserves and how much money they take in for their foreign trade as a net. These things are all positive balances, and they've done very well by the economy. I think it's also fair to say that he has done a fairly effective job in restoring the authority of the state. Now, you know, this is controversial in many aspects, but there were elements of the 1990s which troubled the people like the business community very much, which was that the, you know, the authority of the national government wasn't sufficient to make sure that contracts were enforceable across the whole country or that the application of rules and regulations was uniform and so forth. I won't say that Putin's managed to deal with all of those issues. He hasn't, but he has certainly improved the situation. And he's stabilized a lot of the economic institutions that were very fragile and uncertain. And he brought particularly in his first term from, say 2000 to 2003 or so, he got done a tremendous number of the fundamental economic and judicial changes that Yeltsin's people had pursued for a decade and had never been able to get through, and he got them done in a couple of years. So, you know, he had a pretty impressive record economically in many ways in terms of stabilizing and to some extent regularizing key elements of the of the economic and business community and environment and so forth. Now, I think you're absolutely correct, too, that particularly since 2003, there have been other aspects of what has been going on there under his, what I would call the Putin paradigm, that are less attractive to us and have seemed to undermine a lot, certain of the key elements of, a more open, accountable government. You know, the restrictions on media, the movement away from elected to appointed heads of provinces, and the elimination of the half of the parliament that was elected by single member district, like our congressman and so forth, in favor of a party list system. Backsliding on some of the areas in judicial reform and so forth. These things have certainly not, I would say, you know, led to a more accountable and open government, more based on the population. It has put much more control in the hands of the appointed bureaucracy, and less in the hands of the legislature or the courts. And I think that is, you know, a trend that is has some real problems and some real dangers. But I would have to say that, you know, if you, as I do, we try to keep track of how Russians are viewing their president and their system, you know, he has delivered a better standard of living for a very, very substantial part of the Russian population over the past 4 or 5 years. He has clearly sort of restored Russia to a position of pride and influence in the international system. And to be very frank, Russian citizens seem, as in general, to be less concerned about a lot of the sort of abstract ideas of democracy and human rights than many in the West. They judge those issues very much by how they affect themselves. And while we would argue that there are a lot of areas in which they are subject to, you know, sort of the absence of any regularized and understandable, predictable system or the rule of law, Russian citizens find ways to cope with those realities. And when they weigh that against the more stable and more prosperous Russia that they live in today compared to 7-8 years ago, on balance, Putin's popularity is very high.
We are at our midpoint here. Let me quickly introduce again our guest, and we have a caller we'll get to. In this hour, the guest is James Collins. He served from 1997 until 2001 as the U.S. ambassador to the Russian Federation. He's considered one of the country's leading authorities on Russia and Eurasia, and also on U.S. relations with Russia and the region. He has had a number of postings, several in Moscow, and also other management positions at the State Department and the White House in Washington. Before joining the State Department, he taught Russian and European history, government and economics at the U.S. Naval Academy. He will be one of the participants in a conference that will be going on in the Chicago on the 12th and 13th of this month. This is the Chancellor's Conference on Russia, Business and Politics. And you can find out more about this by going to the website of the Russian and East European Center of the University of Illinois, and you just find that very easily on the web. This is taking place October 12th and 13th at the Palmer House Hilton in Chicago. Questions welcome. Here we do have someone who's been waiting patiently, and we'll get right to them here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, there are people that claim that President Reagan had a lot to do with the fall of the Soviet Empire. I'm curious to what extent you agree, and I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, I think that discussion is an interesting one, and my own view of it is that I would agree with the premise that he had a fair amount to do with the way the events evolved, but probably not for the reason that most people attribute. Most of the argument I've seen or that you see in the American press and so forth revolves around the idea that you know, Mr. Reagan's defense programs put the Russians at such a disadvantage that they couldn't do anything but spend themselves into destruction. I think there were some other elements to this that were critically important and probably more important. But I start from a separate premise, and that is that the United States did not bring the end of the Soviet Union, or, if you will, win the Cold War. Rather, it was the Russian and other peoples of the then Soviet Union that ended it and brought it down. It was really their decision not to support it further that brought it to an end. So the question really is sort of, all right, what was at work here? And I think one of the people with whom I work closely, Jack Matlock, who was ambassador in the late 80s, has a very valid point, and that is that one of the things that the Reagan administration managed to do with President Gorbachev was to convince Gorbachev that the United States was not so threatening to the then Soviet system in a military sense, or in the sense that we were just waiting for some way to attack them and so forth. That Gorbachev felt comfortable and confident that he could, in fact, go forward with a lot of these changes and reforms that, in the end, led to a great deal of the very profound changes that, sooner or later, unwound the whole system. And I don't think Gorbachev ever had that in mind from my dealings with him and knowing him and knowing the history of his administration. He really wanted to reform the Soviet system and make it work. But what he put in train, because he felt confident enough to do so, because I think Reagan convinced him that we were prepared to work out arrangements with the then Soviet government to reduce the levels of nuclear arms and tensions and so forth, what really happened was that he felt comfortable, confident enough that he could persuade his colleagues to go forward with those initial periods of reform. And that really was what began the unwinding of the system. So I wouldn't disagree that Reagan had a lot to do with what happened. I just don't think that it's the usual argument that is the one that, in fact, really probably accounted for the change.
Well, we have some other callers here. Again, I ask callers to try and be brief. That'll help us. We're already in getting into about our last 20 minutes here. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone up next in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Yeah, I'll try to be terse. Welcome back. About a couple of weeks before your vacation, a couple of local economists, I think, were on talking about the business climate, and we got into details about the Yukos. When Yukos was considering selling Mobil Exxon, you know, direct oil rights to their oil fields, that was intervened, and people regard that as a obsolescent contract, I guess. It was changed, and contrary to what I heard you say about most of what we hear is that this is a good example of undermining of contract law, which I was kind of surprised to hear you say that contract law is being reinforced. Now we have the example, another oil example in the Sakhalins, where Shell has put in $20 billion and the environmental consideration is being used to halt that, and it's being called a ruse, and it's being called another way of insisting on renegotiating this production sharing agreement that was instituted. I don't know what the date on that was, but a lot of this stuff seems to date back to when Russia was, you know, the real sick man of Europe, and that the IMF had to bail them out in the late 90s, and that there were a lot of things that were negotiated then, but basically Yeltsin wasn't able to stand up against any of this because of the pressure. It's a third worldization of and using the IMF to get what corporate power wants. That's pretty crude stuff, but I think when crude oil is involved, it's pretty apropos. So I'd like for you to comment on that, and I guess I'll hang up.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, I didn't want to suggest, and I would not suggest, that there are not serious problems with everything, with lots of the aspects of rule of law and property rights and sanctity of contracts and so forth in the Russian economy and in the Russian system. There certainly are. And many of the institutions that we sort of take for granted, or we take for granted in Western Europe, where you've got these long-standing developed governments and legal systems and so forth, simply are not present in Russia yet. The institutions are rather young, they're fragile, there's lots of corruption involved in many elements of the system and so forth. So I wouldn't overdo this. What I was trying to suggest only was that in the Yeltsin period, what happened was that you had a flow of power out to the various parts of the country, into its 89 regions, so-called. And a lot of things were done locally that were incompatible with what was done locally elsewhere, and it was very complex for business people to have any kind of sort of hierarchical system they could even look to deal with their particular interests. So it was one thing to make an oil contract in one province and not have it accepted in another. Now, what's going on today is a different question, and I would not try to say that there are not issues of the kind that you're alluding to. The Yukos affair is a complex business. It certainly had its political dimensions without any question, and it raised many questions about sanctity of contracts, about property rights, about the role of government in its ability to break contracts or renationalize property and so forth, that have unsettled much of the whole system since that case got going. And there are many who would indeed argue that, particularly in the energy field, the government continues to play a role that is difficult to predict and fathom, where contracts are not necessarily seen as the kind of thing that is untouchable if the government has decided that there's something wrong with them. And there is a lot of uncertainty in the whole area of particularly the oil sector. Gas sector is less of an issue, partly because the government has a monopoly essentially in the gas system, where Gazprom basically owns the vast bulk of the production facilities and controls all of the pipeline and distribution system. So, I mean, there's no question that this energy sector is one in which the government is trying to define its position, and where they are not always looking at contracts negotiated at some point earlier as sacrosanct and only the only basis on which they are going to look to the future. Now, their argument is that some of the oil companies and gas companies have not been living up to their end of the bargains either. I'm not going to get into the merits, but you're quite right. I mean, that people are very suspicious of the way the government, which has often been rather heavy-handed, has tried to restructure or renegotiate its roles. So, in short, I would not at all dispute the fact that, particularly in the energy sector, there's a lot of nervousness about how good contracts really are. And there is certainly a lot of problem in the economy as a whole with the fragile and undeveloped status of the rule of law, sanctity of contracts, protector of minority shareholders, and so forth. There are ways of dealing with many of those issues to raise the level of comfort that an investor can have, but they are still a major element of the political risk there.
Again, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, just for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in. I do want to introduce very quickly again our guest, James Collins. He's someone who's had a long career in the Foreign Service. He was the ambassador to the Russian Federation from 1997 until 2001, held other postings in Moscow and also in the Middle East. And questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. If you think back to 1991 and think about the kinds of things that people were saying about how Russia would change, and particularly about how the economy might change and opportunities for Westerners, for Americans, for Europeans to do business there, do you think that, in fact, that some people were overly optimistic about how quickly things would change?
Oh, I think without question. There was a sense of euphoria, which, by the way, was largely shared by most of the Russians that these foreigners talked to. These were the people in Moscow, the people around the government, the central government, and so forth. I think what people often missed were two or three elements that were present that were going to be a major break on the speed and so forth with which change could happen. First of all, I think people underestimated the sort of terrific needs and absence of development and modernization that had gone on and was characteristic of the Russian economy as it sort of left the Soviet system. You know, people talk about the terrible state of healthcare. Well, the healthcare system wasn't very good under the Soviet system. It had a different premise, but it wasn't very good at delivering healthcare. Similarly, I mean, investment in production of modernized manufacturing goods and so forth was way, way down and had not really kept pace except in certain specific, military industrial areas. So, I mean, you know, there was a big problem then. The second issue that was certainly present is that while you changed a lot of people in the central government and in Moscow and at the tops of ministries and so forth, the vast majority of people working day to day and doing the business of the economy in the Russian Federation on the 26th of December, the day after the Soviet Union ended, were exactly the same people who'd been there on the 25th. So these were not necessarily all people who had suddenly a brilliant insight into how a market economy operated or management principles as we understood them in the West and an idea about the role of courts and corporations and lawyers and so forth. I mean, you really didn't change much of anything by changing the top. You changed the political leadership and the group which would define directions, but you did not accomplish this change overnight. And in fact, that took a lot longer than people, I think, tended to understand was going to be required. And thirdly, there was simply a sort of tremendous economic collapse as a result of the Soviet Union's collapse. We would call it a real depression. I mean, there was rise in unemployment. There was a rise in the collapse of the whole sort of economic system in many ways. And one of my best sort of insights into this is that in the middle of the 1990s, I remember going and discussing the economy with a variety of people, and the conclusion was that something like 60-70% of the entire economic activity of the then Russian Federation was done by barter. It wasn't even monetized. And the question of, you know, how our people looked at things as they looked at the monetary figures meant that they were basically looking at about one-third of the economic activity and then drawing conclusions. Well, this led to a lot of things that were, I think, misunderstood, a degree of euphoria, a degree of totally unreal expectations about many things, and I wouldn't exempt myself from some of that. I think all of us were caught up in the enthusiasm of the people we worked with for that things were changing rapidly, and they did change rapidly. But the depth of that change and the breadth of it was a good deal less than in fact we thought. And I think today one has a much more realistic view that we're dealing really here with almost generational type change rather than what you accomplish in a couple of fiscal years as you budget assistance or different kinds of programs in the Congress and in the executive branch of the U.S. government.
So you were thinking that it sounds as if you're saying that we could be looking at, I mean, to really see substantial change, perhaps the kind of change that people might have expected, we're looking at decades more, at least?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's decades, but we're certainly going to have to take I happen to believe that it's going to be at least another sort of half generation or full generation before Russia is comfortably working in ways that make it a sort of easily workable society within the market economics of the sort of globalized system where you have the industrial democracies and so forth at work. I mean, there are just a lot of pressures and strains and needs for change and challenges that are there. And for instance, one of the things that I was told by many Russian friends is that you might draw the line about where the modern and a group of people and the group of people who are comfortable understanding how Russia fits into the rest of the world could be drawn between that group and the older group, which never quite has understood this, simply by the question of who understands computers, who uses computers, who's in the system of, if you will, the electronic world, and who is still back in the system of waiting for the letter. And I think there's a it's probably not that simple by any means, but it is illustrative of a kind of way to look at things. Now, you know, it's also true if you look at it that people who were 20 years old in 1991 are now 35, and they are now beginning to take over management positions, run businesses. They're entrepreneurs. They're a different labor force, and so forth. Those people really never worked in the Soviet Union, per se. They were students or they were only at the beginning of jobs or whatever. They have only known a market-based system or one that was completely different from the then-Soviet system. 10 more years, those people will be 45, and frankly, they'll be running things much more than they do today, and that will be a different world.
We're coming now to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes, and I wonder if I could ask a more a sort of forward-looking question,
sure.
and that being this, that certainly Russia will continue to be an important player on the world stage, perhaps not what it was, but certainly important if for no other reason than it has very significant natural resources. What sort of place do you see Russia taking in geopolitically now here in the near term, in the next few decades, perhaps?
Well, I've always said to my American friends that, Russia somehow is seems always to be important, and particularly to us somehow. And it is for two or three reasons, and I think they do in many ways kind of shape the way you can look at Russia's future. I mean, one is that they are just a huge country. You know, it's 11 time zones. It takes about 10, 11 hours to fly from one end of the country to another. I mean, it's just an immense place. But to a bigger point, it plays a role in Asia, in Europe, and across that whole area of South Asia and the Middle East and so forth, which is so much a part of our focus today. Mm. So, you know, that's one reason it's going to be important. It's a junction point. It's a player in global affairs in three continents, if nothing else, and therefore is just terribly important. Secondly, it has a huge resource base. If nothing else, it has something like one-third of the world's natural gas reserves. It has an abundance in Siberia and so forth, everything that's on the periodic table of elements. And thirdly, for Americans in particular, it's just very hard to see how we're going to deal with the legacies of the last century, the Cold War, nuclear issues, the future of nuclear power generation and so forth, without working with the Russian side, because they're the other people who have that kind of capability for leadership and will play an important role. Now, my own view is that in many areas, probably in the majority of areas, we do not really, the Americans and the Russians do not really have an incompatibility of strategic interest. We may be competitors, certainly will be, but Americans have never been unwilling to compete. But when it comes to strategic interest, it's difficult to see how, you know, we do not share, say, an interest in stabilizing the area that is to the south of the borders of the Russian Federation, in Central Asia or South Asia or Iran or whatever. We may disagree about how to do it, and we may have problems, but I don't see that there's a strategic difference in desiring that that area of the world not become a hotbed of troublemaking for the rest. Because Russia, remember, has a Muslim population of something like up to 20%. They don't want to see that destabilized. I mean, similarly, how Russia is going to play its global economic role is a great question mark. It is certainly competitive in certain areas already. It is a competitive exporter of natural resources. The problem for them is that they want to be competitive in other areas. In the modern technologies as a modern industrial society. And the question of how they're going to get there and how they're going to establish that role, I think, is one of the great sort of problems in front of the Russian leadership, because, you know, it will inevitably involve them in policy choices and decisions about everything from protectionism to the sacrificing of some industries to develop others, and so all of which are politically difficult. Nothing new to us. We've gone through this. Look at what's going on in our automobile industry, or has gone on in our steel industry. They face all these same issues, and they are politically just as sensitive and just as difficult. And how they decide to handle those is going to shape the future of how they will fit into the global economy. And finally, I mean, they do have some basic questions about what sort of a politico-societal system they're going to have. You know, I think if they feel that they can run a modern economy and a modernized society on the basis of some of their traditions out of the last several centuries, I think it's not possible. I think, you know, there are very limited things you can do in terms of sort of a dictatorial, highly centralized, controlled regime to produce modern entrepreneurs, because you cannot command people to take a risk. You know, they need the confidence that if they take a risk, things will work out for them. That's not necessarily the case today in Russia, and it's one of the great challenges that Mr. Putin faces, it seems to me.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time for this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest, James Franklin, he's a former U.S. ambassador to the Russian Federation between 1997 and 2001, also has held a number of other posts in the Foreign Service, in the State Department, and in the White House. He will be one of the participants in a conference that will be taking place next week, 12th and 13th, at the Palmer House Hilton in Chicago. This is sponsored by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center of the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. It's the Chancellor's Conference on Russia, Business, and Politics. And I'm sure that if you're interested in more information about the conference and you have access to the Internet, you can go there to the website of the center and find out all about it. And Ambassador Collins, I want to say to you, thank you very much for giving us some of your time and talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much, and it's good to talk to Illinois because that's my home state, and I look very much forward to being part of the conference that's coming up.
Excellent. Very good. Thank you again.
Bye-bye.